Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman. My
Shaft?
Name is Eric, and I'm... Not Shaft, I'm oh. Eric. My name is Eric, I'm here with Michael, and we're talking about Shaft today on Double Feature.
Yeah, we are.
But we're also talking about another film.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Enter the Dragon.
So it's time once again, I suppose, to revisit genres we were once uncomfortable with.
Kung Pao Fried Chicken, we're going to call this.
Oh, God. Too much racism too early in the show.
Sorry.
We're actually going to do Shaft first.
Uh-huh.
So I guess you might as well get that shit out in the intro.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have a filter on Logic to just cut the racism out. So none of this will probably make air.
You need a chauvinism filter.
So normally, you know, spoiler warning and what have you. Maybe spoilers for Shaft.
Yeah.
I don't know about a whole lot of spoilers for Enter the Dragon.
Yeah,
What do you think?
I don't think that Enter the Dragon is really spoilable. I think the enjoyment from the film comes from mostly beating people up.
And I want to actually encourage people to talk about... We have what I'm pretty sure is going to wind up being a new double feature piece of terminology today.
Oh, yeah.
When we talk about Enter the Dragon. So I think you're okay to listen to that part. If you haven't seen Shaft, I don't know, see that shit first. So if you want to skip over that, you haven't seen it yet, use the chapters. There's chapters embedded in the actual feed of the show. So if you listen to it on an iPod or some such, you can skip over to the next movie. And if you don't listen to it on that, there's stuff in the lyric section so you can figure out where the fuck you're going.
Those are called timestamps.
All right. So in talking about Shaft, a couple things surprised me about the movie Shaft. One is, so we're back in the 70s now.
Yes, we are.
Okay.
1971.
We have, I'm a little bit surprised. I'm watching this and I'm thinking... Gotta be 16 millimeter.
Yeah.
Gotta be 16 millimeter. It's grainy as fuck.
All the people look really dark.
Yeah. So it's actually shot in 35 millimeter, although it is mono.
Yeah. Oh my God.
We've never really talked about this, but I think every DVD you own is in mono.
Yeah. So since I've been, and I guess this is a really good time to address this, but when we first started the show, my DVD collection was heavily 80s with the slasher stuff, and a lot of the 2K movies were all on DVD. But since the advent of Double Feature into my life, everything I own is from 1970.
I don't know how that happened, because I'm not a big 70s guy.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's not me where all that shit's coming from.
I don't know where it came from, but so yeah, all my DVDs are now in mono.
Well, let's look at that year. We're talking 1971, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same year as Clockwork Orange came out. In the mainstream, we're kind of doing the... you know, the DocuSucker stuff, more prominently, I guess, Dirty Harry or Get Carter. Around this time, horror is doing Willard.
The original.
Willard. The remake of which we covered on the show. Sci-fi's got Omega Man. And then the Roadsploitation is just, I mean, it's doing Vanishing Point and it's doing Two-Lane Blacktop.
Yeah, same year.
Another one we probably don't need to cover on the show,
but
should at some point.
Certainly will.
So there's the infamous Shaft trailer that's... I don't know if you've ever seen the trailers for the Shaft movies.
I don't think I have.
They're exploitation as fuck. It's just a combination of scenes from the movie with voiceover. I know that sounds like every trailer, but I mean, there's no more thought...
Does it start with In a World?
There's no more thought put into it than that. There isn't even In a World.
Okay.
It's just... It almost seems to be random scenes from the movie pulled out, and then someone is just doing some...
Hyping the movie up.
Yeah, that's it. That's all it is. And the first trailer ends with Ask Yo Mama, if you can see Shaft.
Okay.
And then the second movie's trailer says, Ask Yo Mama again.
Wow.
And then they get to Africa and no one gives a shit anymore. So
Ask Yo Yo Ma is the third one.
I have nothing to say about that. So the guy who was doing all the artsy shit was busy on the actual movie Shaft and clearly not on the trailer. And, you know, there are some surprising shots where you can tell people, I mean, sometimes we watch exploitation and no one loves their job. Mm-hmm. Everyone hates that shit.
Yeah.
And sometimes we watch exploitation and it looks like these guys got a chance.
Right.
And they fucking tried their heart out. You know, that scene where Shaft first gets back to the little private eye office and he's fighting those guys and you have, you know, the first person fight moves,
right,
which are so unnecessary.
Sure. Well, I think that a lot of that is, you know, to not have to pay a stuntman to get hit.
Okay,
if you punch at the camera, no one's getting hit. You're only paying your actors. You don't need a stuntman until somebody gets thrown out a window.
So you're convinced this is all just straight down to the budget?
Well, that's just where my brain goes, is why would you do that? That looks really, really lame.
But then there's stuff, you know, in that very same scene you have where the guy's woozy from being punched.
Yeah.
And, you know, things are shifting back out of focus. There's just little bits of that sprinkled throughout the movie. The icon of the movie, the guy that
the titular
people remember,
character?
Yeah, is Shaft.
Yeah. Not to be confused with Richard Roundtree.
Yeah, I don't know who Richard Roundtree is. He's like Shaft's alternate persona.
Right.
The one no one talks about.
Uh-huh.
Richard Roundtree plays Shaft.
Right.
Not just in the movie Shaft, but only in his career.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure that's about all. I remember Richard Roundtree as Shaft, but you're convinced that you forget who that is the second the movie is done.
For me, when the movie ends, for me, Shaft is always Fred Williamson. I don't know
why.
Weird.
Why is that?
I don't know. I feel because Fred Williamson to me is bigger and he's got a lot more attitude as a human being. And so that translates better to Shaft because Richard Roundtree as a human being seems like a super nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really difficult for me to place him as
Shaft.
The bad mother, shut your mouth.
Well, you know what helps a little bit is the fucking turtleneck.
Yeah, that's true.
This is the weirdest getup in, you know, the thing that's weird. Okay, so Shaft wears a turtleneck, mm-hmm. which he tucks in, by the way, because that's just what you do with your turtleneck,
right,
I guess.
And then he's strapped with his Saturday Night Special.
Yeah, so he's got that kind of side holster on, which almost looks like suspenders.
Uh-huh.
And over that is, I think it's supposed to be a brown leather trench coat.
Right.
But it looks like it's made out of some sort of plastic mm-hmm. material.
So what you're saying is we kind of, instead of Shaft, we have more of a cool Urkel image?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And it's not even so much just how bizarre that is, but the fact no one even seems to notice
it. Yeah, well, it's weird because Shaft as a character in the film is always 100% John Shaft.
Yeah.
He never pretends to be another person. He never, as a private eye, he never goes undercover, right?
Yeah.
The
bartender.
Right. I guess you're right. But he's
not really undercover.
Once he
then.
Introduces himself, he introduces himself as John Shaft.
Right.
And the thing that I always note is he knocks on the door when there's a group of underhanded criminals with Malcolm X on the wall.
Yeah.
And they ask, who's there? And he says, it's Shaft.
Right.
And instead of...
There's no ruse there.
Right. And the criminals in a normal real life scenario, it's the police would be like, oh, scatter, man, we got the fuzz. But instead, they're like, open the door, it's Shaft.
Yeah, he got us. Well, and it's funny, too, because you know it's only one guy.
Yeah.
It's just Shaft.
Mm-hmm.
And you always get this impression that maybe he's cool with the criminals,
right.
But clearly that's not the case.
Sure, he's not really cool with anyone except the ladies.
So he's always Shaft, and Shaft is a PI. He's a private investigator. Which is such a weird job.
Yeah.
You know, it's very cinematic because it's outside the law. It's a little bit of the vigilante thing. But he's not quite a cop. He's got some sort of badge or something. He's got some sort of relationship with the police
or something. I think there's a weird kind of he used to be a beat cop thing.
Something like that's going on there.
Because I think the dude that ends up helping him out at the end was his ex-partner in some capacity. He could have been a criminal even.
Yeah, there's a dynamic there that's not explored too much. Although the film comes back around to it every once in a while, especially during the super awkward ending. I love how he laughs at his own jokes.
Yeah.
And by love, I mean hate how he laughs at his own jokes. It's just so weird. He'll make a joke and then immediately start laughing.
Well,
you can just tell it's screen directions.
I was just going to say, yeah, it's in the script. In the script, Chef delivers X line and then in parentheses, laughs.
Yeah,
and
he might as well say,
yeah.
Close it yourself, shitty laughs, and walks away.
Right, well, it's kind of like when we did Black Dynamite with Hero, which this show is a nice homage to, where the character in Black Dynamite says, sarcastically, I'm in charge,
or
I have a family show's picture.
Yeah. Yeah, there is so much Black Dynamite in this film. We didn't talk about Shaft a whole lot on that show, but it's whether it's this one or the Shaft film that follows this, it pulls really heavily from almost a complete parody of Shaft itself. An incredibly well done one, and one that brings a lot of its own creative elements to it, but it is Shaft we're talking about. You know what strikes me as really odd about the Shaft character is that he's black and poor?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, I think, okay, so that's clearly, that's the racial gravity comment.
Right.
There, every once in a while, you get a racial gravity comment in a blaxploitation film, sure. which goes to say that we're not exploiting black people. They're the downtrodden, and we're bringing them up.
Yeah, they're the underdogs.
But Shaft is getting paid $50 an hour plus expenses to pick his nose and go around and find some guy's daughter, which he clearly has no problem doing.
Yeah.
He gets shot once.
It's not an issue for him, though. I mean, it's not like this is the hardest PI job he's ever had.
Not at all. But the thing that I like is that he gets brought down, he gets shot.
Sure, he's not invincible.
And exactly, and I really like that dynamic of the film, is that even though, maybe even in his own mind, he's untouchable, you can't fluster him, he's always got the upper hand in conversations even,
mm-hmm.
but he takes a bullet.
It's weird though, that money thing, that he complains about being poor. I mean, so $50 an hour,
mm-hmm.
he's, some quick math here, what's he working for like a week in this movie?
That's like $2,800.
Yeah, so we're talking about, especially by today's standards, he's making at least $30,000, maybe closer to $50,000, just hunting down this girl, which, by the way, I'm not even really sure why they need Shaft to do it.
It seems
like any private detective could have handled this.
There's the bumpy character who is the guy that cries, right?
Right.
The crying, the super heavy character in the film.
Right.
He shows up and he needs John Shaft because Bumpy's a criminal. Shaft is outside the law, but still involved with the law.
Ah, there it is.
And he's black, which means that if the race war that the whole film is kind of telling us is about, it's an imminent...
Tanks on Broadway, man.
Exactly. A race war between the Italian Jews and the black hoods. Shaft is going to be on the right side in this particular case.
It's strange that the movie kind of starts building a race war thing and then just ignores it.
Yeah, there's kind of this weird...
As if to tell you this is what the stakes are.
Right.
And please remember that because we're not going to talk about it for the rest
of the
movie.
It's a weird Detroit 9000 premise that gets swept under the carpet really quick once Shaft kind of gets rolling and is a charismatic anti-cop, I guess.
The legacy of this movie is one that's really long-lasting. I mean, it was incredibly successful.
Yeah.
Not even just for what it was, but by, I guess, any measurable standard.
Sure, well, it even got an Oscar.
Got an Oscar for the music work, right?
Right.
It was the Isaac Hayes stuff. Well, that's kind of an interesting note as well, because this is some of Isaac Hayes' best-known work
for a
soundtrack.
Sure.
You don't see that very often. Yeah, that's even more bizarre. So his most well-known work might be for a soundtrack or for... music he did jokingly for a cartoon, but it is really good, especially that opening scene.
They
build the whole first 10 minutes of the the movie. It's just a really long, it's the Shaft theme song and just Shaft walking around.
Yeah, and it's not an establishing thing of Shaft is a badass. It's more like Shaft walks around New York.
Yeah, it doesn't even tell you too much about the where he lives or the neighborhood.
Or the time of year.
He's just walking around. That's all it is. But the Isaac Hayes song is so good, despite its poor grammar, that you don't even give a shit. You're just, okay, that's fine. Shaft theme song. This is what we need right now.
And there are other songs that kind of pop up in the film, and they're just as enjoyable.
Yeah, he did a lot of the instrumental work, too. I mean, really, all the memorable stuff we're talking about here is the Isaac Hayes songs. And I think that's probably one of my favorite parts of the movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's definitely deserving of the Goldie Baldy.
It's unfortunate that the theme song is the first thing in the movie because it's always kind of downhill from there for me. I just want to hear the theme again until they do the awkward heist at the end.
Yeah, which I always forget about, and for you is apparently what the film is all about.
Well, the film's a couple things.
Uh-huh.
The first thing it is noir pretending to be blaxploitation.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Because we're not dealing with the usual blaxploitation elements.
Not even close.
And the second thing is the heist at the end.
Yeah.
Where they just kind of break in, and then he makes an awkward phone call at the end. Peace out, movie's over.
Yeah.
And then you get the signature Shaft, we didn't have any time to put into this font on the end credits, which continues through
the
other films.
As he walks away into the night.
But we're not dealing with the kind of exploitation that Black Dynamite at its heart was making fun of.
Not even close.
Or when we're talking about something like The Great Coffee or Foxy Brown. I should say The Great Foxy Brown because I love that one.
It's really odd for me that Shaft is the iconic blaxploitation film when of all the blaxploitation films I've seen, Shaft is possibly the least blaxploitation, but maybe that's why it's the one that everybody sees, because it's the most approachable, it's the least strange and obscure. something like Cleopatra Jones is not going
right,
to be
right.
the go-to for the valiant blaxploitation effort of our, you know, decade.
Yeah, you know, it's just like we talked about with Smokey and the Bandit a couple mm-hmm. weeks back, about how that was one of the most successful things that could maybe be considered
sure.
roadsploitation. But in, you know, even in saying that now, I look back on it and say, was that roadsploitation? It's successful. It's a successful piece of exploitation because it's very loosely
sure.
exploitation.
It's the most approachable.
That's why these movies are what they are. That's why they have a cult status. That's why it's a smaller audience that even knows about exploitation, because they're not, for whatever their genetic film makeup is, they're not blockbuster movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see the blockbuster examples of exploitation, they're not always the best representations of the genre because they did something different that allowed them to garner mainstream success.
Right.
And here, that thing that's different is just being The Long Goodbye or being Chinatown.
Sure.
You know,
as opposed to Sweet Sweetback, which came out the same year.
Oddly, some sort of influence to Shaft.
Mm-hmm.
But by taking that stuff out of the detective genre, the pulp genre, it managed to attract a bunch of critics. And then by being good, I suppose, it
yeah.
managed to attract the critical praise and thusly the name it has now.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get too overwhelmed with mainstream success, can I just bring this back into obscurity for
absolutely.
A little bit?
Absolutely. That's my favorite thing to do.
Drew Bundini Brown.
Okay.
So Drew plays, what is it in this movie? Willie?
Willie, who should stop playing with himself.
I keep remembering. Yeah, and they make a joke about it too. Oh, awful. I keep remembering back to his other iconic moments, like people that he played in other movies.
Uh-huh.
You'll never see this guy everywhere. This isn't a name you need to know. But in order to talk about obscurity a little bit here, always something I remember from Shaft is this man's hair.
Yeah.
And he's in Shaft's big score as well. He's kind of the character that comes back for the next movie to make it feel like it's really a piece of the franchise, although it's clearly just one odd actor mm-hmm. that they didn't kill off in the prior movie.
Right.
So he's like a big deal in the next movie. But he has this fucking reverse mohawk.
Yeah.
It's totally unintentional.
Yeah.
It's just the bald spot.
Sure.
But it's, you ever see the David Lynch movie Dune?
Nope.
Of course not. Why did I ask you that? It's a really odd movie. And part of the sci-fi element is, you know, this reverse mohawk hairstyle. Cher's son, Elijah Blue Allman, had a reverse mohawk for a while. Look up the reverse mohawk on Google Images. It's probably one of the worst haircuts of all time. And this man accidentally was born with one. I feel bad for him. So we have not only the sequels, but a sort of remake thing
yeah.
that happened. There's Shaft's big score
right.
after this, and Shaft in Africa.
Uh-huh.
Now, what's really weird about the Shaft trilogy is that's the first time the word Shaft trilogy were ever uttered in the history of humanity. Have you ever heard of the Shaft trilogy?
Not really, no.
No, of course not. Nobody knows that. You've probably heard of Shaft in Africa, though.
I have heard of Shaft in Africa.
Yeah, so people know about Shaft. They know about Shaft in Africa. No one is aware that there is actually another movie called Shaft's Big Score.
Which is the one in between.
Yeah, right. It's the second one. So it doesn't just go from Shaft and then Shaft comes back and now he's in Africa. There's a whole fucking movie in there that nobody even knows about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why no one knows about. I don't know what the deal with it. It's the same director, too. I don't know if there's a strange distribution thing there. You know, a movie that got so much critical acclaim, no one has any idea. It's still Richard Roundtree.
It's
still Shaft.
It's possible that people just think it's the same movie.
That might be what it is. Shaft's big score continues a trend that we didn't talk about yet, but it's James Bond.
Yeah.
It's, you know, this came out the same year as, what was it, Diamonds Are Forever? I think it's the seventh James
I've
Bond
seen
movie.
Like four James Bond movies.
That is totally okay that you've seen four James Bond movies. I'd like to officially go on record before year eight of Double Feature, where
Bond-a-thon.
We have to do all the fucking Bond movies. I hate the Bond movies. I think they're chauvinistic. I think they're simple. I think they're base, repetitious, and they do barely anything interesting for the 29 hours of your life you need to. It's probably more than 29 hours.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Probably something like 36. I'm just making up numbers now. That you
I
have
liked
to dedicate
Casino Royale
to watching
a hell of a lot.
There you go. That's a totally appropriate opinion. You know who did like the Bond movies is the people who made Shaft. You don't see it a lot in the first one. But the second one especially, there's this
gadgets.
Casino kind of scene, and it's more the Goldfinger kind of stuff, the painting bodies, and there's a whole body paint weird scene in this. It's actually pretty cool.
Uh-huh.
But by the third one, they're actually making James Bond references in the
okay.
movie. He gets gadgets. I mean, the whole thing is really, especially for a movie set in Africa.
Yeah.
Really, really
You really,
bizarre.
If you want to have gadgets in Africa, show up with a fucking walkie-talkie and a can opener.
And then there's one other piece of Shaft lore, I suppose.
Yeah, there's the Samuel L. Jackson. So it was up until, you know, recently, I was under the impression it was a remake of
Shaft. I think everybody's under that impression.
But the reality of the film is Richard Roundtree appears in his award-winning role as John Shaft.
Of course, he couldn't let a movie. He couldn't let any kind. I imagine Richard Roundtree goes to the blaxploitation version of Comic-Con every year and reprises his, you know, he shows up and signs Shaft autographs. He couldn't let anything go out under the Shaft name without, you know, getting involved himself. But I'm sure they reached out to him. Who cares how it happened? But he winds up in Shaft.
As John Shaft.
Right.
Which, upon hearing this, I wonder, well, is Samuel L. Jackson his twin? Does he get plastic surgery? Are we going to pull a Foxy Brown thing here? But it turns out that Samuel L. Jackson plays his nephew and is just a young John Shaft, so he's even more of a renegade, and they can set it in modern times, and they don't have to betray the blaxploitation 70s vibe, because it's his ancestry.
Right, right.
That is John Shaft.
And no one expects Richard Roundtree's character of Shaft to be anything different than how he was in
Exactly.
They wouldn't have it any other way. Mm-hmm. So really, we have four movies. In the, as when we consider a slasher franchise, we would consider pseudo-remake prequel things within the franchise. I don't think this is a Shaft reboot.
I think it was supposed to be a reboot, but...
So I'm going to go ahead and say there's four movies in the...
Shaft trilogy?
Yeah, in the Shaft trilogy, thanks. Gladly, Enter the Dragon is still back in the 70s, which, by the way, was when nudity was still okay.
Yep.
Did you notice this?
I did.
Just normal movie, hanging out, happens to be a lot of nudity.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, the 70s.
Yep.
Now, that's like fashion, right? Where it comes back in waves. That's going to happen again at some point.
Yeah, a wave of nudity is just around the corner.
Oh, God, I'm waiting for it. But you know what I mean? In film, where all of a sudden there'll just be a whole decade or hopefully 50 years of cinema where people can just hang out and be naked and it's not going to be...
Extra money, extra ratings.
A movie nobody sees that falls into obscurity because there's nudity in it. Oh, so fucking disappointing. But it's Enter the Dragon and there's naked people. So, what's going on with blaxploitation and kung fu? Because there's a connection here, right?
There is. And
this isn't just an accident, as you would have had me believe, that we keep doing these movies together.
No, it actually, the connection has a name.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Jim Kelly.
And really?
This is his first, really, debut in film. He plays Williams.
Not to be confused with Willie from the last movie.
Exactly. But he was in a bunch of blaxploitation films in the 70s. He was in Three the Hard Way. He was in something I think called Afro Ninja. He was in a ton of these kung fu blaxploitation films.
He's a martial arts guy, right?
Yeah, and first and foremost a martial arts guy. I think in just about every one of the movies he owns a dojo, which is, again, I'm not even going to get into martial arts. But the thing about Jim Kelly for me is that he barely qualifies as blaxploitation.
Mm-hmm.
He has the afro, he has the look down, but he
never... The sounds, too, always important. I always forget the sounds in these movies.
Yeah.
The whip snap, what is that, meat slapping, whatever the fuck they do to make those sounds. And then also, we have to talk about the Bruce Lee sounds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, how would you describe those?
The sound like a surprised chicken?
It's a chicken, right? That's what they... Oh, God. It makes it terrifying. And when the camera just stays on his expressions, and he makes these noises... I don't want to use awkward because I used awkward to describe the end of Shaft, and it's not that kind of awkward, but it's another kind of, it's like when you're on the train and you catch someone staring at you,
right?
And you kind of get frozen where you're staring at them and you can't avert your glance. That's what's going on with Bruce Lee in this movie. Anyways, you were talking about black people.
Well, the thing about Jim Brown, and it's really noticeable in this film, is he has a bunch of those sassy, quippy, Shaft-esque lines where he comes off as the badass, cool black guy.
Does he come off as the badass, cool black guy? He's not Shaft.
His smiles are ingenuine. It seems like he's almost embarrassed to be the sassy black dude.
Right.
It seems like he wants to show up and kick ass.
Right.
He doesn't want to be the sex symbol that kind of goes hand in hand with being a blaxploitation icon.
It's weird. I wonder if that's part of his fame or not, part of his infamy. I can't tell if that was just his thing to play the guy who didn't want to play those roles.
Mm-hmm.
Because for as much of an oddity as that is, you see that pop up. I mean, that's every scene that he plays in the whole movie where he's just somewhere between. It's almost like it's satire of blaxploitation. Look at this this actor who was in an era that fell out, and now he's this kind of cast out guy and has to play these roles. That's the vibe you get, but this is clearly still in the era of blaxploitation.
It's in the heart of what's going on.
So I guess that would make him Jim Kelly, reluctant kung fu black man, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. He's great. I love him.
Yeah, that's the weird part, is that that character is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
That you love watching him not like the not like the role he's playing.
Exactly.
You wouldn't want to see any other type of movie with him in it. That's the fucking role that you're interested in. And we go from something like that to Bruce Lee, which is completely different, as we'll talk about with our tournament blueprint.
Yeah.
Completely different role that happens to come together in this odd collection of people from around the globe who come together.
Who have seemingly nothing in common except the urge to win. Well, Bruce Lee in the film is the character whose name is Lee. Mm-hmm. He's also the character who has about 96% of the screen time in the film.
Yeah.
But Bruce Lee is the icon of kung fu.
Mm-hmm.
Now at the time in the 70s, there were no other kung fu icons. It was Bruce Lee or bust.
He was the name. He was the go-to.
And now we have Jet Li, Tony Jaa, Jackie Chan. I mean, there's five or six big kung fu names. But back then, it was Bruce Lee.
Even now when there's a decline of kung fu popularity compared to that time, it's weird that we have so many more so many more names.
Well, and the thing is I kind of think of it in my head is it's almost a schism where Bruce Lee was the best there will ever be because he's a great fight choreographer. He does all the fight choreography in Enter the Dragon.
Sure.
He's a good actor. He's very charismatic. He knows his way around a frame. He's just an all-around great kung fu character.
He's a perfect fit for these movies.
Exactly. And so I feel like now that since he's died almost immediately after this film, that there's kind of been a schism in the kung fu school where you get your acting from Jackie Chan. He's got the comedy over here. Jet Li does all the crazy shit you didn't think people could do. Tony Jaa does all the wonderful choreography.
Right.
But you don't have all of it in one package anymore.
People have their different specialties.
Exactly.
Like that. So you mentioned something to me as we were watching this about real kung fu.
Yes.
Where do you make that distinction? What is that?
Well, I think a lot of real kung fu, one, it's got to come from the 70s.
Okay.
I mean, that's where the kung fu thing started.
Sure.
And I'm not talking David Carradine kung fu.
No.
I'm talking, you know, the kung fu from China, whip snapping sounds.
Yeah, yeah.
And bad dubbing.
The authenticity you're talking about.
Sure. And it's all the film. It's kung fu to me is a film where the plot is secondary.
Yeah.
It's kind of like in the 80s when there was the big, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's a big advent of stunt films.
Oh, sure.
In the early 80s where it was just people crashing cars because it looked cool.
Right.
And the plot was absolutely negligible. That's how I feel about what I would call real kung fu, is you're there to watch some really artistic fighting. And the reason the fighting's going on is all well and good, but as long as the plot gives you a reason to fight, you're on board.
And Enter the Dragon gets those visuals right. It gets the just the entire craft of filmmaking around kung fu, you know, so spot on. There's that scene early on with the you know, where he's doing these incredible moves with the guy who has a scar over his eye.
Yes.
And there's some super legit slow-mo stuff in there.
Yeah.
Especially for the 70s.
Absolutely. And it's the kind of thing where if you can almost imagine being in a group full of men, everybody would kind of roar as it went into slow-mo.
I'm of the mindset where I would actually flee from that scene.
Oh, right.
I see people fighting and I'm going to take off and catch it on YouTube later. But there's that one. There's the one in the heroin lab later on, too. Where when we look back to a lot of the slow-mo stuff in the 70s, it's almost part of the signature of that era, you know, in the same way to talk about things like zoom lenses.
Dramatic slow-zoom stuff.
Yeah. Part of the 70s was jerky slow motion. It was not having an adequate frame rate on the day that you shot and deciding in post or just maybe not having the equipment available for whatever reason. You see these really jerky slow-mo shots, something that almost looks like the zombies from 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't move naturally. But when they showed up for Enter the Dragon, they had the right fucking machinery. They knew well in advance that they were doing these scenes in slow motion because they wanted it.
Well, then that's a kung fu thing, right? Mm-hmm. Slow motion is definitely something that kung fu calls for.
It allows you to appreciate what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the entire art form of kung fu, to look at it as as something more similar to dance than right. to martial sure. arts.
That's why I like the term fight choreography, because yeah, that's right. what it is.
It legitimizes it. Instead of making it that sort of bullshit pseudoscience board-breaking nonsense,
yeah, exactly.
it becomes, you know, someone sat there with a fucking pencil and paper mm-hmm. and came up with, you know, kind of like when we talked about Equilibrium, about the choreography yeah. there, about Kurt Wimmer in his backyard, uh-huh. having to come up with these ideas. How are these going to be done? What were the moves going to look like? Do they look pleasing in front of a camera?
Well, and do you buy them? Do you buy that these people are getting hit? And there's the one fight where both of us were questioning whether sure. the New Zealander was actually getting
yeah, actually up. Getting his ass kicked. And so when it's done well, you have to appreciate that art mm-hmm. form. It's really incredible. There's a lot that goes into it. And slowing it down allows people who can't, you know, inherent in that art form is that you can't really appreciate it if you can't do it.
Right.
You know, magic's always my fucking go-to for that kind of shit on the show. But if you don't know the behind the scenes of that stuff, it's hard for me to just watch people fighting in real time because mm-hmm. I don't know anything about choreography, in the same way that it's hard for me to watch dance and appreciate and have any idea what's happening there.
Right.
But if you slow it down, I have the time to see the expressions, how the people feel in the moment, how their punches are landing, if that's believable, that component of it, how the bodies are actually working within the confines of that 16:9 or that right. 2-3-5-1 frame that they're in. And it just gives my mind the time to react, especially when you're dealing with something like fighting, where your internal instinct is to go, oh shit, people are fighting,
yeah.
and overlook all of that stuff. So the slow motion is perfect for that. But back to that other characteristic you were talking about, mm-hmm. the thing called plot that has to show up right. in these movies.
Yeah.
We have the fighting tournament blueprints.
Fighting tournament blueprint.
Not the first time we've seen that on the show.
No, it's definitely not.
DOA was the classic example. Absolutely. All the way back in the beginning of year one, where we saw, I mean, what is this fighting blueprint?
A group of people of the same talent. In this case, they're all fighters.
Sure.
Who are completely a hodgepodge from all over the globe,
mm-hmm.
are chosen as the best in their field, in their region, in their area, and called to a single locale, probably an island, where they will have to spar with each other in order to find out who is the reigning champion. And they all show up with different motivations. They all kind of are familiar with each other. A couple of them are friends from their past, and right. there's a newbie who wins.
Yeah.
The newbie always wins.
Yeah, there's never any question about who's going to win. It's almost as if that formula begs you to ask which one will win.
Right.
As if that's where the suspense is. But sure. you know who's going to win.
Yeah.
Always you know who's going to win.
And the thing that is always a twist in the tournament blueprint formula is that turns out the whole tournament is the facade of a seedy underbelly
sure.
in which the tournament is actually fueling what is going to be a very catastrophic event or business. In this case, it's heroin dealing.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you mean all these people coming together internationally from around the fucking globe to come fight? That's not just for the amusement, the entertainment of one rich man?
No.
Fuck, how did I not see this coming?
I'm sorry. Did this get too confusing for you?
So I want to put out a quick challenge.
Uh-huh.
I think this might be the first fighting tournament blueprint movie.
It's possible.
And we wouldn't have any idea.
Nope.
So that's why I'm saying might. I want to just kind of put that out to the people listening to the show. If there is a movie that follows the collection of warriors from around the globe come together to fight for the amusement of one man seated underbelly thing, doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. I would like to know if Enter the Dragon actually came up with that. We're just going to declare it winner by default
sure.
until someone challenges that.
This will be our tournament blueprint theory, is that it was started, and theories are meant to be proven wrong.
Via an internet tournament blueprint. Beautiful. What's pretty amazing about Enter the Dragon is that this blueprint has only been done worse.
Yeah.
I mean, you really don't ever get much better than what Enter the Dragon's put together and mm-hmm. why it's done that. The other movies kind of just steal the exact ideas so that they have their own excuse to do kung fu. I think the only thing anybody has ever added is better roles for women.
Yeah.
Which comes through, you know, modernization.
Or cars.
Literally the only role for women in this movie is in the brothel.
Yep.
I mean, that's it. There is not one woman in the entire movie.
His sister, who Harry carries herself so she doesn't have to get raped.
Yeah. You see what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The only real female person and not just a fuck puppet commits suicide. Can't deal with it, man. All the men are overwhelming her.
It's hard to be a woman, I hear.
Yeah, so that sucks, but I'll forgive Enter the Dragon for that. And as these movies go on, you see the badass female figures.
Sure.
Which isn't, I mean, something that I even want to commend modern movies for, because that's become an archetype in cinema anyways.
Sure.
Just badass, you know, Resident Evil fighting woman, whatever. Mm-hmm. So of course we're going to add it to the updated blueprint. So there's one other thing I really want to talk about with Enter the Dragon, and that's that I was a little afraid to cover this movie on the show.
Sure.
And I mentioned that back when we did the Black Dynamite one, you know, the entire idea of movies, double feature, not ready to cover, whatever. And Enter the Dragon, I'd never seen, and it's a big piece of Kung Fu history.
Sure.
A genre I know little to nothing about.
And all the artwork is really kind of Asian influenced. It looks very artistic and completely unapproachable.
Yeah, so I'm thinking high art movie, I'm not going to understand. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking hero, really.
Yeah, right.
Something I'm going to have to really fucking concentrate on and focus.
And subtitles and colors.
Right, and what we're getting is more akin to Escape from New York.
Yeah.
This is, thankfully, there's Han in this movie.
Right.
So Han is the supervillain arch nemesis guy. Right. And if anything makes this movie approachable, if there's anything I can say to an audience that hasn't seen this movie yet that convinces them, all right, this movie isn't too fucking complicated for me. You have Han with the fake hand.
Yes.
His name is Han. He has a fake hand. And this is exposed during, I don't even believe I'm saying these words. His fake hand is exposed during the disco fight scene.
Right. Okay.
So he literally reveals this hand, and then it cuts to a scene right afterwards, right after the fake hand, it cuts to a scene of him diabolically petting a white cat.
Yep.
In, I'm not done, a hand museum that he has created with all of his interchangeable hand pieces.
Right.
It might sound like maybe I'm just making this funnier than it, but it has even less tact than I am allowing it right now. And we go right from the Dr. No petting the kitten scene to kitten decapitation.
Right.
So I'm thinking we have unapproachable movie, but actually the movie pets a white cat, right?
Right.
That's how we'll know, hey, you know what? Fucking movie, it's not too hard. Just watch it. Everybody makes it sound like it's a lot artsier and unapproachable that it is, when really there's a Dr. No villain or something where the movie's just, it's a lot more ridiculous.
It pets the white cat.
It pets the white cat. Thank you. That's why we need a phrase for it. And that tells you a lot about what kind of movie it is. I feel like there's a lot of people who haven't seen Enter the Dragon. It just gives off this idea other than what it truly is at heart. There's a lot that people don't know about it. It's, I mean, the simple concept, first of all, that they've already seen. They've seen everywhere. You told me, all right, don't worry about Enter the Dragon. We've seen DOA. Did you remember DOA? You got DOA. Okay, you got Enter the Dragon. And that's really all it is. It's a pretty simple format. And then it gets heisty a little bit too, with the music especially makes it really heisty. It's not really until that final mirror scene that the art gets a little intense.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time, you know, you're getting a headache watching this. It seems insane and complicated to shoot.
Right.
But you just have to pull yourself back and remember that as they shot that, it didn't have to make any sense.
Right.
I'm sure their biggest problem was concealing the camera. You don't actually have to know where the characters are, what angle is bouncing off what, because the whole thing's a fucking illusion. All they have to do is shoot a bunch of people in mirrors. It looks confusing as shit, and no one's gonna... It's not like someone's lining up the trigonometry at home.
And the whole premise is that the characters are confused themselves.
Exactly, exactly. So you're just pointing mirrors in a lot of directions and making people confused. How perfect of a fucking ending metaphor for what this film
Absolutely.
Is. Absolutely. So that's an odd thing to talk about the first piece of Bruce Lee's career, because while he was doing dubbing for this movie, that's when he died.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of... he had these collapses, I guess these kind of headaches or seizures. And one day he went to bed and didn't wake up. And it's weird because I'm trying to figure out, all right, this is either the first thing or the last thing Bruce Lee has ever done. And if you find out what movies he's been in, that doesn't really help explain that at all.
Yeah, not at all.
Because there's a Bruce Lee movie that came out in 78, you know, 7 years after his death. This is only one of the big three movies he's considered famous for.
Right.
And so I think this is definitely one of those guys, at the very least, you could say he died well before his time.
Absolutely.
Everybody dies well before their fucking time. But he accomplished something big, and before even really getting the recognition for it, before being able to go on and do all these other things, you know, he could have had a 50... I mean, look at David Carradine. David Carradine, since Kung Fu, has gone on to do a lot of stuff, most of which we talk about on the show all the time.
Yeah.
That same kind of length of career could have been Bruce Lee's as well. Tell me the website, motherfucker.
Oh, the website is doublefeatureshow.com. You can enter the tournament of tournament blueprints by sending us an email to doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. You can donate to us by going to donate.doublefeatureshow.com.
Turns out some of those people might actually pick the movies we're doing at the end of the year.
That's impressive.
Listen to any other show we've ever done to hear about that.
And what? I guess we're doing two more next time?
Of course we're doing two more next time. So warning people up front, they're shit movies. They are awful fucking movies. You're giving me the raised brow. Are you ready? We're going to do The Room and The Happening.
Oh, what a good fucking time.
So I've never said that about two movies we've ever paired before. But I mean, The Room is laughable, haha, good, you'll have a good time. And The Happening is just offensive in how goddamn awful it is. But there's a question to get to there, which, if you can read into that sentence a little bit, has maybe already presented itself.
Watch more fucking film.
Or don't. Bye.